Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today is Monday. It's June 24th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I'm pleased to advise you that Michael Edelman Esquire, the political analyst, he's already online, so I'm going to say hello to him in a moment. And just so you know, John Bailey, who usually starts off our Mondays, he kickstarts it with his adrenaline, and then it's always balanced out a little bit later on at 10:30 with Michael Edelman. So John will be away today as well as next week. He's on vacation. So good morning, Michael. How are you, sir? Okay, for some reason, I don't hear him at the moment, but I see that he's on. So maybe he's out of range or something. So in the meantime, what we're going to be discussing with Michael Edelman are a couple of major issues. One, of course, is the announcement by the president that he was going to delay deporting people who are recognized as being illegal immigrants within 2 weeks. Time frame, but he's delaying it. He was going to do it this weekend, but he's delaying it for 2 weeks. So the question is why. And then here it is. It looks like Michael Edelman's on now. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, Hezzy, how are you?
Okay. Oh, a pleasure to have you on this morning. Thank you for making the time. I appreciate it. Well, Michael, you know, there are a lot of big issues. So I have a short list today, but one of the things that was very disturbing is not maybe the conduct of the president, but just the fact that he threatened that he would go after illegal immigrants and pick them up and deport them. And that was supposed to take place this weekend, and then he delayed it by 2 weeks. What's the concept that goes behind this? Is this a threat to drive people out on their own? I can't make any sense of it.
He's trying to show his base that he's tough.
Uh-huh.
And when he knows in reality that they don't have the capacity to pull this kind of thing off, and that the optics of dragging people out of their homes with children, these are primarily families, would be terrible.
Right.
They have no place to house them because families have to be housed in different places, single male adults. So the whole thing doesn't work. But he said anyway, because he just wants to rattle his sabers to make his base believe he's going to get rid of all the illegal immigrants that we might have in this country.
And does that work? Does that concept work with people, with his base, whatever his base and however that base is defined? Are they like drinking it?
Yes. They are. Basically
they are.
Shrinking. Only 37% say he should be reelected, according to a Quinnipiac recent poll. That is remarkably horrendous.
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, that's, you know, I was very interested to find out about that because it was very important. And then I do want to go into, like, a central issue. And that's about the introspection over the origin of the Russia investigation. And you wanted to go over that because I think it's I hope you to go over that because it's important for people to recognize the complexity of it all. Is it too complex for most of us? Is it because, is it just too difficult
not if you take the time to read it. If you take the time to read the material explaining how the counterintelligence portion of started, it's not complex at all. It's really quite simple. But the problem is people in America who support Donald Trump don't want to know what really happened. They'd rather listen to Sean Hannity entertain them with misinformation, and they believe what Hannity says, what Lincoln says, and what Ingram says, and what Peter says, and they don't really care about the facts.
So is that the problem with our electorate, that we don't, we are not taking the time? Are we so removed from the process that we're just, I don't know why we vote then at this point. You know, are we just voting for the best looking, the one with the most money,
what
is it about? Some of us.
It should be a civil obligation that you take seriously. Well, what's the point?
Yes,
well, the point is that there are enough people in the country that don't vote Republican just because they're Republican, and don't vote Democrat just because they're Democrat, and don't vote based on whether they hate women and a woman is running, and don't vote based on false allegations by far more campaigns. They do the research. They look at the facts. They weigh the evidence. They decide who will be comfortable in the White House, and then they vote. There are enough of those people to determine the election properly, with the exception of 2016, when Russia interfered in the entire process, thereby electing Donald Trump.
And do people realize that there was a relationship between the or an effort by the Russians to find out what was going on with the Hillary Clinton campaign and all the people that Trump surrounded himself with that were questionable in their conduct with Russians and with the Soviet Union, or the places that they had influence, like Paul Manafort and Carter Page and Michael Flynn? All these people were
and Rudy Giuliani.
And Rudy Giuliani, who came in with a bang and is leaving with a whimper. He may be already gone, for all I know, but he said he was going to be leaving after a certain point.
With regard to Rudy Giuliani being the personal attorney for Donald Trump, Giuliani made lots of money from foreign sources, so much so that during the vetting process for Secretary of State, there was a separate 25-page dossier on Giuliani's foreign connections and the money that he was raking in from Russia, from Turkey, from all of these places that no Secretary of State should have a monetary connection with, which is obviously one of the reasons he didn't get that post and shouldn't have gotten that post. But it's also very damning that Giuliani insisted on defending Trump from the Mueller investigation. He obviously had money riding on it. And it was foreign money that was riding on it. So people have to read the part one and part two of the Mueller investigation. Then they have to read the articles that are reported in The Atlantic and in The New Yorker on how the counterintelligence investigation got started. And they also have to understand that there were over 140 contacts between Trump's campaign and Russian officials or Russian oligarchs or Russian intelligence people or lawyers working for the Russian government. They need to understand that Russia did a systematic and massive cyber intrusion during the 2016 election that mathematically had to have affected 45,000 in three states.
Doesn't this imply in a very, very almost just a deduction or an inference from all these people that were involved with Russia? Has Russia been in the United States all this time? You know, underground, nobody knew that they were involved, that they were watching and engaged in every election, and there's so much corruption with our people here. Few years.
Yes, it started in 2000, and it started when the Russians understood that Hillary Clinton was going to be the candidate of the Democratic Party because Putin can't stand Clinton. He blames her for the volatile demonstrations in Moscow against him. And he thinks she had something to do with making those occur. And he vowed to beat her and elect Donald Trump. And there is, in my own opinion, this substantial monetary connection between Donald Trump and Russian oligarchs and Donald Trump and real estate projects in Moscow that suggest to me, as a former prosecutor, that Putin and the Russians had plenty of information they could have used against Donald Trump, but did not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called compromise.
Yeah. So where do we go from at this point, considering, you know, there was this fantastic article in The Week, which I think is pretty pretty middle of the road, so they could lean a little left, a little right, sometimes just quite in the center. But the thing that's their writing about this whole issue was really quite succinct and in your face if you didn't know about it. Where do we go from here? Are we stuck now in this administration with these sort of games that are being played behind our back and a lot of people still refuse to recognize it?
Well, it's unfortunate that people don't come to grips with the fact that Russia meddled in the election. They don't want to believe that, partly because Trump has done everything he can to deny it, because he understands that if the Russians participated in electing and if they had even a minimal effect on the outcome of that election, he's an illegitimate president.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the last thing he wants to be, is an illegitimate president. It's like Roger Maris hitting 60 home runs.
Yeah.
He's got an asterisk because the season was longer for Maris than it was
for
Babe Ruth. Okay, and that's what Donald Trump does not want to be in the history books. But guess what? This saga will be written long after Donald Trump leaves office. We will find out exactly what happened. Okay, there will be confessions of people that were involved that can't sleep at night. There will be revelations from FBI investigators. Andrew Weissman, for example, is writing a book as we speak. Mueller will testify ultimately, one way or the other, either in person before the committee or by answering written questions. This is not over yet, and Donald Trump keeps attacking Hillary Clinton as if he's running against her. And what will happen here is that slowly but surely, some people that voted for Donald Trump because they thought they were getting a brilliant businessman and somebody who was going to clean the swamp are going to come to realize that his tax cuts for the rich, his immigration policies, his trade wars, and his policy on the border with regard to these poor kids that are not being treated any better than you would treat a stray animal. No clothing, no diapers, no medicine when they're sick, no water, no showers, no soap, no toothpaste, that is going to be his Waterloo. The American public is not going to put up with a president who uses children to make a point with his base. And Donald Trump's time in office will be over sooner than you think.
Why, though, is it? It seems that there's like an undercurrent of, gung-ho for the president because he's being so strong on the border, and yet it seems from a humanitarian perspective, we're mistreating these people who, by our law, are permitted to ask for sanctuary. And where's all this coming from? Where's this anger? Are we so angry at people who come to the United States? Have we been very anti-immigrant all these years? Or is it we just don't like them because they're a little bit different than who we are? But then considering we're so many different people from so many different lands.
He's got his,
is it just
we're always hating
somebody?
Yeah, but the old white people don't want the young brown people in the country. Okay, because they know that the chances are, and they're not even, they offer the argument that, well, the Democrats want these people in so they can register them Democrats. Well, they're not citizens. They can't vote. So, if that happens, they'd have to go through this whole process taking years and years and years and years to become citizens. But the fact of the matter is the demographics of this country are changing. Is becoming a minority-majority country by 2030. Black, brown people will be in the majority, and there are white people that resent that for lots of reasons. Social class, privilege, their perception that the jobs are going to be taken away, and all of this other stuff. But that does not excuse the way you treat little kids who are considered unaccompanied because they're not here with their own mother and father. Even if they come with a grandparent, they're considered unaccompanied. Yeah. Even if they come with an older sibling, they're considered unaccompanied. And that's why they're segregating them, because of the no-tolerance policy of Donald Trump. Obama never did this. W never did this. And the fact of the matter is, these people aren't coming from Mexico, and they're not trying to storm the border. They are coming from the triangle nations of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and they're running away from drugs, violence, and murder. And they, under international law, they are entitled to a hearing. They are entitled to attempt to establish their right to asylum. Only about 25% are able to do that. The rest get sent back. But there is a process that this administration does not want to follow. And that process is to conduct a hearing. Why don't we take all of the retired judges around the country and pay them a salary to go down to the border and adjudicate these cases quickly rather than 6 months or 8 months or a year? The law says in the Flores settlement that children cannot be held more than 72 hours, period. Kids are there for weeks.
Yeah.
So the violation, what the Trump administration is doing is a violation of established law.
Well, you know, it's so interesting that this has been going on like this, and yet there's no pushback. There's no legal pushback against the president or even the administration. Where are the different operations around the nation that would say, okay, this is totally illegal, let's sue and let's go to court with it? I always wondered why we didn't have more judges to adjudicate all these issues. Doesn't it cost us more? Or is it the whole idea is just to make it what it is? Which is so debilitating.
You gotta be kidding me. When he wanted to build a wall, he found $4 billion.
Yeah.
How much could it possibly cost to get 100 judges down there? And you give them a stipend.
Exactly.
I mean, you're not talking a lot of money.
No.
You're just not talking a lot of money. $100 million? To clean up the whole problem?
Yeah.
That's if Trump really wanted to clean the problem up. He does not. He wants the problem to fester so he can pander to his base about how he's keeping immigrants out of the country. That's what he wants. He doesn't want a resolution. He wants to keep the issue going.
Well, that's the tragedy of it. But there doesn't seem to be any real pushback other than I mean, isn't there any legal way of getting this resolved, or is there no way?
Suing the HHS? Yeah, maybe, but that would take a while.
That would.
Meanwhile, the kids are going without diapers. So the Trump administration could fix this problem in 24 hours. The problem of these kids not getting medicine and not having blankets. Not having soap and things.
Yeah.
That's not a legal thing. That's a thing that nations do to protect children, no matter where the children are.
Right. Yeah. That's very evident. That's for sure. Well,
we are not a nation of detention camps.
No.
Yeah,
we're not
a nation of detention camps. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where does this come from that we have this? Remember, I wasn't around then, and I don't think you were then either. And when they had the detention camps for the Japanese in the United States, where does this anger come from?
Well, it's always fear of the other. That was World War II, and the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and Roosevelt decided that the Japanese Americans were going to side with their own relatives, but the problem, the Germans in New York City with the Bund.
Yeah.
There was a larger problem in terms of loyalty to the United States with the Nazi Germans that were living in this Hitler than there were with the people that were hardworking Japanese immigrants on the coast. But we've always discriminated against Asians in this country and not against white Europeans, even though those white Europeans, many of them were supporting Adolf Hitler.
Yes, that's right. And So really, I mean, is it, you know, I never, you know, personally, I never found anybody from Asia, you know, difficult to get along with. But then I get along with people from all kinds of different backgrounds. But I don't understand.
You've never played golf with an Asian American.
No, but I don't play golf. So that's my excuse. So, but evidently,
they're very, very slow.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I thought they were probably brilliant as they are in so many different aspects.
It's a golf joke.
Okay. All right. That went over my head. Well, I wanted to ask you also about it seems that we're fighting a new type of war, certainly with Donald Trump. Like there was supposedly an attack against the Iranian computer systems. Does that open up a new world of pushback? Are we going to be attacked at the same time with our infrastructure that's been said to also be very vulnerable?
Yes, of course. Of course we are, and of course Iran. Donald Trump doesn't seem to understand that when the leaders of are religiously motivated, like they are with the Ayatollahs in Iran, reason escapes them. They're not interested in bargaining with us and giving up their nuclear weapons. They're interested in keeping their power and their hegemony over the area. That's what they're concerned with. So we had a nuclear deal, the JCPOA. It was working. They wouldn't have been able to enrich uranium for 10 years. We were hoping, I think, that within that 10-year span, maybe the two countries could get closer together in terms of trade and other things so that they weren't as anxious to blow Israel up and everybody and fight Saudi Arabia. But nevertheless, we had a deal, and that was the best deal we were going to have. Now Trump pulled us out of the deal because everything Obama did, he wants to undo, whether it's good or bad, whether it's right or wrong, whether it made sense. He's not evaluating anything based on the merits. He's evaluating on whether he can undo Obama's legacy. That's what he wants to do because for him it's personal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now let me ask you something. You withdraw from the JCPOA. What do you expect Iranian response to be? Okay. No, they're going to enrich uranium tomorrow morning. That means they'll have a bomb in 6 months. And if they have a bomb in 6 months, we will not be able to militarily do a thing with them because they will threaten their neighbors with nuclear weapons.
Well, that's what's so interesting as well about all of this stuff. So they're supposedly getting to the point of that baseline where you cross over to being able to create the nuclear weaponry. I think it's supposed to be on the 28th that they reach that point of this month. What's interesting about all of this is that it seems that they're also building a consortium of countries that are a part of the process with them. You know, they've got the Houthis in Yemen. They're now formulating a relationship stronger than ever, and they're going to even have military, I don't know what they call it, games with Iraq. And so that's going to happen. They're already in Syria. They're in Lebanon. What's happening? Are they controlling the entire Middle East? From the Mediterranean Lebanon, that area all the way to Iran?
That's what hegemony is.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what they're trying to do.
Yes, it is. And they're getting there.
We had an agreement. We had an agreement that they were abiding by, and that's according to the Atomic Energy Inspectors.
Right. I've heard that.
And Trump Trump blew it up. He blew it up. He didn't try to make it better. He just blew it up. Okay, so now what does anybody expect to happen? He tightened the sanctions on them. You're going to tighten sanctions. They're not going to change their mind because of their economy, and there's not going to be a revolution in Iran because of their economy. They're going to end up starting a war somewhere.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. I, I mean, it's the only reason that we're demonizing Saudi Arabia is because of the Khashoggi killing, which now we're finding more and more as time goes on, that supposedly Mohammed bin Salman was involved, more so than people originally thought.
He had to be involved. No Saudi would ever do that without the prince's consent, if not his order.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And so therefore, I mean, I have no question of that. I mean, if that's what our American sources are telling us, I believe them. I don't see why they would even try to create a storyline that is incorrect. But why are we blaming the Saudis for the starvation that's taking place in Yemen? Shouldn't there be blame for against Iran for formulating all this stuff? Because the Saudis didn't begin this crisis, did they? Not that I understand.
There's plenty of but they're using munitions and they're blowing up civilians. And when you're fighting a war, you're supposed to minimize casualties. You're supposed to minimize civilian casualties. And apparently, with reckless abandon, the Saudis are not doing that. They're simply, lobbing projectiles into Yemen and creating havoc. So, but these are proxy wars in Yemen. Iran has its proxies in there, and frankly, I think Saudi Arabia will eventually attempt to get nuclear weapons as well because they want to be able to defend themselves when Iran has a nuclear weapon, which was exactly why you don't get out of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're doing is you're encouraging nuclear proliferation by getting out of the deal.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other thing is with Saudi Arabia, I understand there's a question for the British. There's a company called BAE, that's British Aerospace or whatever, and they've been selling armaments to Saudi Arabia, and now the Brits are questioning whether they should even be allowed to continue to have to be able to buy and supply themselves with all these items that are, basically for war.
Right.
But it's all business, and so, where do the rules come from? These silly games.
Did you see Donald Trump's response to Chuck Todd when he asked him about Khashoggi?
I didn't see that yet. I know that I know it's
Trump
on YouTube,
said,
and I've got to see that.
Yeah. Donald Trump said, "Hey, they buy $400 billion of equipment from us." They create jobs with their purchases. He's not going to do anything but be transactional. All right? If they're buying stuff from us, he doesn't care who they kill.
Okay.
Even though the guy was a resident of the United States and worked for the Washington Post.
Right.
So
that I understand.
When we give up our standards, and we stop being a model for the world, then it's over for the United States in terms of being a world power, because the Chinese model works better, people are going to say. They know it's totalitarian, but it works.
It does work. It's an anomaly in the world, because we would have thought that societies would want a democracy, more rights, more transparency, which they're not getting from the Chinese. But the Chinese are not going to relinquish their power Xi Jinping is there for life, right? So the longer he lives, at least we'll have that. Why is the world looking to America from a different prism? And when did that happen? Is that because of winning the war in World War II? And why are we losing our way in the world? Are we making mistakes for political policy around the world? When did that begin?
Yeah, it began when Donald Trump started destroying the 70-year post-World War II liberal order by dissing his allies because he thought they weren't giving enough money to NATO.
Yeah.
And when he started admiring Kim Jong-un, Putin, and Erdogan. Okay, yeah. So that's not the way an American president is supposed to conduct foreign affairs. And when that breaks down, then you have allies saying, well, we can no longer rely on the United States. We've got to rely on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And weaker countries start doing, including Israel, for example, start doing business with China.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the case.
That's where we are.
Chinese are out. Chinese are really making inroads all over the world with business and so on. And
exactly.
Is this also a retaliation with what was going on with Huawei? But evidently the sanctions America had against China seem to be really hurting them as well as us. So what's the end game with this? Or is it not going to work at the end? It's just going to – we're going to suffer probably
you
more
got me.
Because
I don't
we may
Trump,
not be resilient.
I don't think Donald Trump doesn't have an end game. He doesn't think think this out. He's got people around him who think that trade wars are good and you can win them. And most economists know it's not true. There's no such thing.
Unbelievable.
Everybody gets hurt, and particularly the American consumer.
Absolutely. Evidently, that is the case. Well, Michael, I see that we've stretched the hour, the half hour, and beyond even its parameters. So I want to thank you for making the time very, very compelling today. As usual, this is better than having a cup of coffee to wake up.
All right.
So are you going to meet any Orientals, Japanese, on the golf course today? Or are you not sure?
I'm not going to play today, but when I do play, generally they're there. They're welcome to play golf. just have
that
to play
fantastic.
Fast. That's all.
All right. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there. All right. Thanks again,
right.
Michael. What a pleasure. All the best.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, boy, there's so much. Thank you very, very much. Well, there's so much to really engage in right now, and thank goodness for Michael Edelman, because it's always a smart move to talk to him. And definitely is a political jolt, you know, better than a cup of coffee or your second cup, if that's the case. So that's really pertinent. Well, there are a lot of things. Let me take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be right back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, it was great of Michael Edelman to deal and engage in this question. And I wanted to read some more information to you about the United States ditching the old military ways in favor of a cyber offensive. So evidently, Trump has no real appetite for a repeat of the Iraq campaigns. That's what experts are saying. So a debilitating cyber attack against Iran reportedly ordered by the United States President Donald Trump as military tensions spiked last week is a clear example of how modern warfare is changing. So the cyber attack was aimed at disabling Tehran's missile system ahead of planned airstrikes against three unnamed targets that were then aborted at the last minute, with Mr. Trump saying the loss of 150 Iranian lives would be disproportionate to the downing of an unmanned U.S. drone, which seems like a very weak argument that he, of all people, would make. So Iranian officials did not react to the cyber attack claims reported by the U.S. media yesterday, But such tactics would underline how any conflict is unlikely to take the form of previous U.S.-led military interventions in the Middle East. Yet today's report, I wrote this up yesterday, today's report ends up suggesting that the Iranians were able to foil this effort. So, quote, overthrowing the Iranian regime through military force, as the United States did in Iraq and Afghanistan, is completely off the table. That's what Seth Jones, a political scientist at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a think tank, said. And he says there is no appetite for that from Trump or any of his cabinet. So instead, the plan has targeted strikes against Iranian missile batteries and radar targets, showed that the U.S. would follow a similar playbook to air attacks on Syria in 2017 and also 2018, which weren't really reported, and missile strikes on radar sites operated by Iran-aligned Houthi forces in 2016. Again, not reported. Now, look at the options the United States has given against Iran and against Syria and in Yemen. That's what Henry Boyd, the analyst with the International Institute for Strategic Studies think tank, said. These could include operative strikes against radar sites, something that indicates the Americans can and will hold the Iranians responsible for their actions and that they can inflict damage on the Iranian military. So the U.S. has deployed cyber attacks against Iran before. Along with Israel, it was widely believed to be behind the Stuxnet computer virus that destroyed centrifuges at an Iran at a uranium enrichment facility in Iran's Natanz nuclear site back in 2010. Now, yet one challenge involved in using cyber attacks against Iranian military targets would be in identifying their effectiveness, said Mr. Jones. It also does not have the same sort of response publicly that a more direct military response would have done. So the question for military analysts is whether such attacks can deliver the intended message to the leadership in Tehran and reduce tensions in the Gulf. Now, those remain high following a series of incidents, including the downing of the $130 million U.S. surveillance drone and recent attacks on tankers in the Straits of Hormuz that the U.S. has blamed on Iran. So over the past 2 months, the Pentagon has deployed the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and its strike fleet, consisting of up to 70 attack aircraft and at least 3 guided missile destroyers to the area. So it has been it has also sent B-52 bombers to its air base in nearby Qatar, and has F-35A and F-15 fighters jets based in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. In addition, the U.S. Navy has its 5th Fleet in Bahrain, and Marines from the 22nd Expeditionary Unit are stationed aboard the amphibious assault ship USS Kearsarge. So, yet such traditional military force may be of limited use against an opponent that will seek to use its proxy forces and powerful ballistic missile strike capabilities rather than enter a land war against U.S. forces, which is exactly what Michael Edelman had advised. So the United States is the IISS's annual analysis of global armed forces states that Iran's 125,000-strong Islamic Revolutionary Guards exerted, quote, significant military influence via a range of regional allies and proxies, including Houthi rebels in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The risk for the United States is that by attacking military targets in Iran, it provokes the Revolutionary Guard and its allies to hit U.S. interests in the region or even Israel. So if you consider where Iran has placed its money since the 1980s, it has not been in building strong conventional forces, said Mr. Jones. Their army, air force, and navy are relatively weak and not well funded. According to a research paper by the Brookings Institution published this year, Iran has an arsenal of 15 different types of ballistic missiles with ranges of 200 kilometers up to 6,000 kilometers. So that's like 200 is, 180 miles to 360,000 miles. If 3,600 miles. So the country also has a new anti-ship missile, which it fired from a submarine in test in February. And faced with such threats, analysts said that the U.S. might have to constrain itself to limited kinetic responses, such as the airstrikes that were later aborted, more strategic cyber attacks, or even through economic force. And my sense of this at the moment is that the U.S. is more willing to fight this through sanctions, not even indirect military force, said Mr. Jones. Analysts also noted that how Iran had stepped up its own offensive cyber capabilities. Cybersecurity experts have blamed Iran for a significant cyber attack in 2012 against Saudi Arabian companies using a virus known as Shamoon. A similar attack was launched last year, cyber experts say, and there is no question that there was or has been an increase in Iranian cyber activity, said Christopher Krebs. He's the director of the United States Department for Homeland Security for this Homeland Security Cybersecurity Agency, in comments reported by U.S. media over the weekend. So Iranian actors and their proxies are not just your garden variety run-of-the-mill data thieves. These are the guys that come in and they burn the house down. So very, very compelling perspective, that is for sure. So something to think about. Now, let's look at some other stuff that's of value. And bear with me a moment. I want you to check this out. And this is another big issue that's going to be decided upon probably very shortly. So we're going to need to find out what's going on. It seems the White House is waiting to hear if citizenship can be on the census. The Trump administration will soon learn whether it will be allowed to hold to add a question on citizenship in the 2020 census, a decision that could affect political representation for millions of people, business decisions in one of the world's most important consumer markets, and billions of dollars in federal spending. So the Supreme Court is expected to hand down its ruling at the end of the month, in time for the U.S. government to start printing the millions of census forms that will be distributed for the once-a-decade count of the U.S. population. Opponents say the effort to add the citizenship question is a political ploy to suppress the participation of immigrants and Latinos, undercounting the population in Democrat-leaning areas to the benefit of the Republican Party and its supporters. So Republicans say the question can help generate a more accurate picture of the U.S. landscape by getting a better count of the citizen and non-citizen populations, which would be crucial to the ongoing debate about immigration. But an estimated 11 million undocumented migrants live in the United States. And it is possible their households will decline in part to participate. Democrats say the Trump administration's aggressive rhetoric has made immigrants generally less willing to respond to government surveys, fearing the administration would use the information to target them or their families. One judge has already ruled that Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, violated both the law and the public trust, quote unquote, by adding the question, should the Supreme Court overturn the decision, the effects could reverberate throughout the country for years to come. And Chris Warshaw, a political science professor at George Washington University, estimated that the self response rate for the census, if the citizenship question were included, would likely to go down by 5 percentage points among immigrant populations, which includes both citizens and non-citizens. A drop of that size would lead to California and Texas each losing a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, Mr. Warshaw had predicted, as both states have large Latino and non-citizen populations. New York and Florida could also lose, or each lose a congressional seat, while a predominantly white house, white state might end up holding on to a House seat it would have otherwise lost. An even bigger shift may happen on the state level, where the new census data could be used by Republican state legislatures and governors to actually redraw district maps. And this could heighten the consequences for the 2020 election. If Republicans can retain unified control over all state legislative bodies in a state like Texas, they'd have a lot of ability to redraw the map in a way that would lock in that power for years to come, Mr. Warshaw had said. And census results are also used to help distribute an estimated $880 billion in federal spending every year for education, public health, infrastructure, and transportation, as well as federal financial assistance programs such as Medicaid. And that leaves that means that districts with fewer residents filling out the survey could see a drop in funding. It could also affect how much consumers reliant on federal support, such as low-income and elderly people, have to spend. Just one of several ways that businesses say they could be affected by the question's inclusion. So a group of companies, including Uber and Lyft, jeans maker Levi Strauss, an ice cream maker Ben and Jerry's, have told the Supreme Court that an inaccurate count could affect data-reliant decisions such as where to build stores and warehouses. The first time a question about citizenship was included on a U.S. census was 1820. It was removed in 1950. An official worried that it was affecting the accuracy of the headcount. So that's the reality there. Now, let's quickly move on to some other issues so that we can talk about what's going on. And evidently, getting back to this whole issue about the United States is going to introduce new sanctions as Pompeo seeks a global coalition against Iran. It seems that the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said he wants to build a global coalition against Iran during urgent consultations in the Middle East following a week of crisis that saw the United States pull back from the brink of a military strike on Iran. So Pompeo spoke Sunday as he left Washington for Saudi Arabia, followed by the United Arab Emirates and Sunni Arab allies who are alarmed by Shiite Iran's increasing assertiveness and are working to limit its influence in the region. His stops in Jeddah and Abu Dhabi were hastily arranged late last week as additions to a trip to India, from where he will join President Donald Trump in Japan and South Korea. They were not announced until immediately before his departure in a sign of fast-moving and unpredictable developments. We'll be talking with them about how to make sure that we are all strategically aligned and how we can build out a global coalition, not only throughout the Gulf states, but in Asia and in Europe, that understands this challenge as it is prepared to push back against the world's largest state sponsor of terror. That's what Pompeo said about Iran. But even as Pompeo delivered his tough talk, he echoed Trump and Vice President Mike Pence in saying that the U.S. is prepared to negotiate with Iran without preconditions in a bid to ease tensions. Those tensions have been mounting since Trump last year withdrew the United States from a global nuclear deal with Iran and began pressuring Tehran with economic sanctions. A fresh round of Iran sanctions is to be announced today in a bid to force the Iranian leadership into talks. On Monday, officials in Moscow said Russia and its partners would take steps to counter the new sanctions, described by Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov as, quote, illegal, end quote, without identifying what those steps would be. In remarks carried by TASS and RIA, the news agencies, Russian news agencies, Sergei Ryabkov, a deputy foreign minister, said that the U.S. sanctions would aggravate tensions and that Washington should instead be seeking dialogue with Tehran. Well, Pompeo's trip comes after a week of topsy-turvy pronouncements on U.S. policy toward Iran that careened between the bellicose, the conciliatory, and back again after Iran shot down an American military drone and boasted it would not bow to Washington's pressure. And Trump initially said that Iran had made, quote, a very big mistake, end quote, and that it was, quote, hard to believe, end quote, that shooting down the drone on Thursday was not intentional. He later said he thought it was an unintentional act carried out by a loose and stupid, quote, unquote, Iranian, and called off retaliatory military strikes against Iran. So on Saturday, Trump reversed himself and claimed that Iran had acted, quote, knowingly, end quote. But Trump also said over the weekend that he appreciated Iran's decision to not shoot down a manned U.S. space plane, and he opined about eventually becoming Iran's best friend, quote, unquote, if Tehran ultimately agrees to abandon its drive to build nuclear weapons and he helps the country turn around its crippled economy. So then Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, who stepped in Sunday with a blunt warning from Jerusalem when he was traveling. Bolton said Iran should not, quote, mistake U.S. prudence and discretion for weakness, end quote, after Trump called off the military strike. And Trump said he backed away from the planned strikes after learning that about 150 people would be killed, but he said the military option remained. A longtime Iran hawk, Bolton emphasized that the U.S. reserved the right to attack at a later date. And, quote, no one has granted them a hunting license in the Middle East. As President Trump said on Friday, our military is rebuilt, new, and ready to go. That's what Bolton said during an appearance with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, himself a longtime and outspoken Iran critic. On Sunday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani blamed the United States, quote, interventionist military presence, end quote, for fanning the flames. Shortly thereafter, Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen launched an attack against an airport in southern Saudi Arabia, killing one person and wounding seven others, according to the Saudi military. And such attacks have been cited by Saudi and U.S. officials as example of Iran's malign behavior in the Middle East. Pompeo, who dressed reporters from the tarmac before he boarded his plane in Washington, declared the goal of his talks with the Saudi kingdom and the United Emirates is to deny Iran, quote, the resources to foment terror, to build out their nuclear weapon system, and to build out their missile program. We are going to deny them the resources they need to do that, thereby keep American interests and American people safe all around the world, said Pompeo. So the downing of the unmanned aircraft marked a new high in the rising tensions between the United States and Iran. The Trump administration has vowed to combine a maximum pressure, quote-unquote, campaign of economic sanctions with a buildup of American forces in the region following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers. So U.S. military cyber forces on Thursday launched a strike against Iranian military computer systems, according to U.S. officials. The cyber attacks disabled Iranian Revolutionary Guard core computer systems that controlled its rocket and missile launchers, the official said. And yet the Iranians said that is not the case and that they were able to scuttle the efforts by America. So very, very compelling. Now let's look at one more thing. Evidently, there are potentially dangerous heat waves set to strike Europe. Intense heat is forecast across much of the continental Europe over the coming days. Temperatures are expected to peak at about 105 degrees on Thursday in Paris, and it's unclear how long this heat wave will last. The numbers are ranging in the next week from 90 to about 105 degrees. So June is typically a month of gentle warmth in Europe, marking the beginning of summer. However, this year's June has been anything but gentle, and there have been turbulent storms, floods, giant hailstone showers and lightning, and sometimes all during the same day. And now the thermometer is set to dramatically shoot up with an abnormally early heat wave forecast for next week. And this unexpected heat wave has been caused by, quote, a storm stalling over the Atlantic Ocean and high pressure over Central and Eastern Europe, according to international weather site AccuWeather. And these conditions will bring very hot air from Africa northwards across Europe. AccuWeather says this will set the stage for a potentially dangerous heat wave to occur over a large portion of Western and Central Europe. Cities including Madrid, Paris, Belgium, meaning Brussels, Frankfurt, and Berlin, can expect a persistent heat wave with daily temperatures near or above 90, 92 for at least 6 days, and nights are not going to be expected to be much cooler. And mind you, this will go up to as much as 105. Temperatures could approach or even exceed the 105 in the hottest locations on Wednesday and Thursday. Spain's meteorological agency, AEMET, issued a yellow alert, quote unquote, for severe weather on Sunday and says it expects to see a hotter than usual summer like this, like last year. So in Germany, forecasters are predicting temperatures of up to about 37 degrees centigrade, which will make it about 95, 96, 97 degrees on Tuesday, a little bit higher on Wednesday, with similar heat also expected in Brussels and in Switzerland. Now, French national forecaster Matteo France warned that the heat wave will begin tomorrow, particularly in the east, with temperatures of up to, 95, 97 to even about 100, 102 across much of the country. And this heat wave could be remarkable for how early it has come, as well as its intensity. That's what Matteo France predicted. The one region of France that will escape the stultifying area or the heat is Brittany in the west, the northwest. And France's health minister, Agnès Buzyn, warned local authorities, hospitals, and retirement homes to be on high alert, noting that last summer's heat wave resulted in 1,500 more deaths than normal in July and August. The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, activated a level 3 heat wave action late, on Sunday for the more extreme days. And this is particularly severe given that there are just four levels and level 4 has never been used. So the prefect tweeted that it had decided to launch a departmental heat wave management plan, level orange, which is 3 in Paris on Sunday, that had been developed with the mayor. And this plan provides for the establishment of a network of cool places, and the city has identified 922 such public locations, with 218 of those accessible at night, including gardens and parks, cemeteries, swimming pools, churches and museums. The most severe recent heat wave in France was in 2003. It was described as the worst heat wave in Europe since 1540 by meteorologists, and there were almost 15,000 heat-related deaths in France during the months of July and August of that year, according to the country's National Institute of Health. And during it, Paris hit its current record high of 40.4% Celsius, which is 103 degrees. However, temperature in the French capital is set to soar to very close to that record this coming week and possibly exceed it. So very frightening. But Friday, Wednesday and Thursday look to be the highest. It's very, very unbelievable. Well, we're expecting a heat wave that will affect more than half of France of maximum intensity. The hottest day reached will be comparable to 2003, not very far in away in any case, said meteorologist François Gouron at the Météo France press conference. And this heat wave promises to be unprecedented for a month of June, continued Gouron. He said he also said that temperature records for France in June look set to be broken. So the highest temperature ever recorded in France so far was about 110 degrees on August 12 of 2003 in a region of Gard, G-A-R-D, in the south of France. So there's some survival tactics to stay cool during the heat wave. Stay damp. Take regular cold showers and stick your feet in a large saucepan of cold water. Keep wet tea towels in the fridge and wrap them around your neck when you're overheating. Swim. The best way to cool the blood is to swim in natural water, but this is tricky in Paris, for example. It is illegal and highly dangerous to swim in the Seine. There are only a few open-air pools in the city center, and they will be overflowing. And sadly, the public swimming pools in the canal basin do not officially open until July 6. There are, however, many indoor pools, and they are certainly going to be cooler than being outside in the air. In addition, there are plenty of fountains to sneakily stick your feet into. The Trocadero fountain near the Eiffel Tower is particularly popular with adults as well as kids. So you got to find a seat in a library or museum with good air conditioning. Bring a book and stay as long as you can until they kick you out. Shop slowly. Go to the local supermarket. Spend a couple of hours near the freezers deciding what frozen peas are best. And this might sound foolish, but this is widely regarded as a wise thing to do when you are dangerously overheating. The frozen food and fresh fruit sections will bring your blood temperature down. Stay hydrated, but not by guzzling chilled rosé. Alcohol and heat are a very bad combination. You will feel worse and not better. Water, water, and more water. That's the that's what you got to do. So stay out of direct sunlight. Dance in the shadows. Stay on the shady side of the street. Carry an umbrella. Use a real one and not a delicate lace parasol. You need to block all rays. Stay indoors during the hottest hours with windows shut and blinds pulled. It might seem contradictory to have windows closed when it is so hot, but the accepted advice is to close the windows and blinds while it is still relatively cool outside and keep them closed until after the sun has set and it begins to warm up. Go underground. You know it is hot when the metro station seems cool. However, though the trains themselves can feel like a furnace, there is a good breeze on metro platforms. So go deeper. One of the best secret heat wave escapes in Paris is into the tunnels of the catacombs, and these mortuary tunnels stay at a regular temperature of about 70 degrees, which is blissful when it's about 95 or so outside. So these are the same great examples. This is what's going on in Europe. And these are the same examples that are worth thinking about when a heat wave strikes you anywhere in the world. So very, very compelling. Now let me quickly look here for a moment. It looks like, I think that I just Let me just quickly see if there's anything else. I don't think there's much. Well, we should cover this as well. Evidently, the Czechs are demanding that their prime minister step down in the largest protest since the communist era. So an estimated 250,000 Czechs rallied in Prague on Sunday to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Andrej Babiš in the biggest show of public discontent since the 1989 Velvet Revolution, which overthrew communism. The rally in Letná Park was the culmination of a series of demonstrations in recent weeks against Babiš, who has faced investigations over alleged fraud and conflicts of interest, claims he vehemently denies. Organizers say they believe that about 250,000 people had attended Sunday's rally. The phone operator T-Mobile said its network usage analysis put the number of participants at over 258,000. A police spokesman declined to give an estimate. And the total population of the Czech Republic is 10.7 million. So this is an unbelievable outpouring of disgust. What a demonstration. And look at what else is happening. Evidently, Jared Kushner's $50 billion economic plan for Middle East has been criticized as a non-starter. Arab politicians and commentators greeted U.S. President Donald Trump's Middle East $50 billion economic vision with a mixture of derision and exasperation, although some in the Gulf called for it to be given a chance. In Israel, Tzachi Hanegbi, a cabinet member close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, described Palestinians' rejection of the peace to prosperity plan as tragic. Said to be presented by Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner at a conference in Bahrain on June 25 to 26, that's tomorrow, the day after, the blueprint envisions a global investment fund to lift the Palestinian and neighboring Arab economies and is part of a broader effort to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. We don't need the Bahrain meeting to build our country. We need peace, and the sequence of the plan, economic revival followed by peace, is unrealistic and an illusion, Palestinian Finance Minister Shukri Bishara said on Sunday. So the lack of a political solution, which Washington said would be unveiled later, prompted rejection not only from Palestinians, but also in Arab countries with which Israel would seek normal relations. From Sudan to Kuwait, commentators and ordinary citizens denounced Kushner's proposals in strikingly similar terms, colossal waste of time, quote-unquote, non-starter, quote-unquote, dead on arrival, quote-unquote. Egyptian liberal and leftist parties slammed the workshop as an attempt to consecrate and legitimize occupation of Arab land, and said in a joint statement that any Arab participation would be beyond the limits of normalization with Israel. And while the precise solution of the political plan has been shrouded in secrecy, officials briefed on it say that Kushner has jettisoned the two-state solution, the longstanding worldwide formula that envisages an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. So the Palestinian Authority is boycotting the Bahrain meeting, saying only a political solution will solve the problem. It said Kushner's abstract promises were an attempt to bribe Palestinians into accepting Israeli occupation. Now, the White House has not invited the Israeli government to Bahrain. On Israel radio, Hanegbi said Washington had tried to create a little more trust and positivity by presenting an economic vision, but had touched a raw nerve for Palestinians. They are still convinced that the whole matter of an economic peace is a conspiracy aimed only at plying them with funds for projects and other goodies, only so that they will forget their nationalist aspirations. And this is, of course, just paranoia, but it's another tragedy for the Palestinians, he said. U.S. allied Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, will take part in the Bahrain gathering, along with officials from Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco, and Lebanon and Iraq will not attend. And those who think that waving billions of dollars can lure the Lebanon, which is under the weight of a suffocating economic crisis, also into succumbing or bartering over its principles, are mistaken. And that's what Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri had said. Lebanon's Iranian-backed Shiite group Hezbollah, which wields a significant influence over the government, has previously called the plan an historic crime, end quote, that must be stopped. So thousands of people marched through the Moroccan capital of Rabat on Sunday to express their solidarity with the Palestinians and their opposition to the Kushner plan. We came here to speak in one voice as Moroccans and express our rejection of all conspiracies that target the Palestinian cause, Slimane Amrani, the Vice Secretary General of the Kingdom's co-ruling Islamist PJD party, told Reuters. Arab analysts believe Kushner's economic plan is an attempt to buy off opposition to Israel's occupation of Palestinian land with a multi-billion dollar bribe to pay off the neighboring host of billions, or rather of millions, of Palestinian refugees to integrate them. After Israel's creation in 1948, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon absorbed the most Palestinian refugees, with some estimates that they now account for around 5 million people. In recent years, Iran's bitter rivalry with the bloc led by Sunni Muslim Saudi Arabia has increasingly pushed the Arab-Israeli struggle into the background. So while Riyadh and its allies have welcomed Trump's harder line against Tehran, which has cast itself as the guardian of Palestinian rights, critics accuse Saudi Arabia, the custodian of Islam's holiest places, of abandoning the Palestinians. And Muslim scholars in the region, who would have been in the past rallied popular opinion in support of the Palestinians, were largely silent hours after the plan was released, in a sign of a crackdown on dissent in several Arab countries. So, my goodness, that's the story there. Well, I think that's where we'll end today. I want to thank you for being with us. Let me just quickly look to see what's going on for tomorrow. We should be speaking to Robert Keston tomorrow from 10 to 10:30. Sean Patterson Howard, 10:30 to 11. Karen Beltran from 11 to 11:30. And then Clyde Isley from 11:30 to 12. My God, what a day, huh? So there's a lot to talk about then. So we'll speak to you. We'll speak to you tomorrow. And don't forget, tomorrow is June 25th. It is a primary date, and I think in order to be involved, in order to be engaged, you can make a decision. There are many races that are so, so important. I can't even express how important it is, and I think people's involvement is going to be very telling. And I don't think there's going to be a large turnout, so every vote will count, and it could make a big difference. So big question is, who's going to do the best job in getting out the vote? We'll eventually find out. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. All the best, and thank you for being with us today. And goodbye.